Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You're all saying it with me. She's recording it on Tuesday morning. I am. We interviewed this fabulous writer from the Washington Spectator. Her name was Ann Nelson, and she wrote an article entitled Project 2025, The Latest Plot Against America. It's such a chilling article. She is such a brilliant talker that I've actually invited her to come on every week to talk about Project 2025. But I'm going to add to that. I'm going to enhance this conversation. And I'm going to start my show almost every day by reading something about Project 2025. And frankly, I'm going to pull nuggets out of her fabulous piece at the Washington Spectator. And I'm going to set the stage with this. Project 2025 is actually the opening salvo of the 2025 Presidential Transition Project. This comprehensive playbook was produced under the auspices of the Heritage Foundation and supported by over 100 partner organizations. Officially, it is titled Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. Its perverse genius lies in its sheer length. 900 pages, much of it mind-numbing bureaucratic prose. But ignore it at your peril. The massive tome is the latest iteration of a four-decade-long process of crafting right-wing policies to dismantle the federal government, deregulate industry, and eliminate consumer protections and public health measures while installing a regime controlled by fossil fuel interests and the religious right. That's from her piece at the Washington Spectator. Every day we're taking a nugget out of that piece. You have to know about Project 2025. And if you ignore it, you are ignoring it at your peril because they have told you what they will do. Now the question is, will you vote for it? Will you embrace it? Or will you remove it as a possible future for America? Joining us right now is Anders Croy. So Anders, he is the communications director for Florida Watch and DeSantis Watch. It's an accountability project, and we have him on almost every 2 weeks. If it isn't Anders, it's got to be about Florida. I mean, what's going on here? So Anders, there was a series of things I wanted to talk to you about. Obviously, everyone's tongue is wagging about what the Florida Supreme Court did, upholding strict abortion bans while giving voters a say in November, this sort of split the baby decision. But then there are a whole bunch of other things. Like you mentioned that on Easter Sunday, they had thousands of Florida kids were told that they were going to be losing their Medicaid coverage. How Christian of them. I mean, this governor who wraps himself in his religiosity. And then what do they do? I mean, on top of it, it's on Easter Sunday. And what does he do? He goes after the administration, the Biden administration, because it is LGBTQ transgender, you know, recognition day worldwide. And he wants to cover so no one knows what he's actually doing by taking this coverage away from children. But then there's also another story that I wanted to cover, which was about the Florida's insurance crisis just got worse because of what? Because 115,000 homeowners in the southwest portion of the state are reeling, not only from the destruction wrought by Hurricane Ian that never really got addressed, but they are now seeing a 25% increase in their flood insurance rates. So I want to welcome you back to the program, Anders, and thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you as always, Arnie, for having me on and the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners. As you just mentioned, yesterday were a lot of mixed feelings here in the state of Florida. We obviously got the news that the Florida Supreme Court had broken 40 years of precedent by removing abortion protections previously provided by the Florida Constitution, which will trigger a six-week abortion ban that goes into effect in 30 days. Now, that being said, I want to make it very clear that right now for those next 30 days, abortion in Florida is still legal up to 15 weeks. And that's a big deal because I know you may have some listeners in the Southeast who may need care. And Florida is one of the places, along with Virginia and North Carolina, that's been able to provide that care in an area of the country that's experiencing a public health crisis. But at the same time that we got that ruling, the Florida Supreme Court did already affirm what we already knew, which was that Amendment 4 clearly satisfied the requirements for placement on the November ballot. That is the amendment to limit government interference with abortion, because we all know that government should not interfere in personal medical decisions that should be between patients and their doctors. And doctors and nurses at the same time should not have to risk criminal prosecution to treat the patients in front of them. We are extremely excited that Floridians will have the opportunity to reclaim their freedom from government interference by voting for Amendment 4 this November. Because the fact is, we can never know what someone else is going through. We're not in their shoes. And that's why this amendment is so important, to keep government out of our exam rooms and make sure Florida families and the doctors who treat them can make the decisions that are right for them. So
now, can you just explain to me something? I want to make sure I understand this. Is this a codification of Roe? What are the limits on this? Because, you know, different states have actually embraced broader protections, you know, lesser protections. What are the protections that are being offered to the Floridian voters?
This amendment would provide access to abortion care for patients up to the point of viability by limiting government interference in those decisions. As I just outlined, and as many people have found out over the course of the last 24 hours, Florida state government, led by Ron DeSantis over the last 2 years, passed first a 15-week abortion ban, which challenged our constitutional right to privacy, which has been recognized in the Florida Constitution for almost 40 years. As the governor was gearing up for his failed presidential campaign, they came back and passed an even more strict 6-week ban that will now go into effect. It's been triggered by the Supreme Court's decision yesterday, striking down that precedent with regards to the right to privacy. So this amendment is vitally important to the thousands of patients every single year who seek abortion care in the state of Florida. And we think that it's a real opportunity for Floridians to come to the polls and reclaim the freedoms that our governor and our state legislature have tried to take away from them. Because the biggest thing here, Arnie, as well, this is not a bipartisan issue. We know from public polling time and time again, this amendment is getting over 60% support, which is important in Florida because our constitutional amendments need 60% to pass. We are not just a bare majority state. We need a supermajority of voters. And we know that whether you are Republican, Democrat, no party affiliation voter, reproductive freedom is not something that breaks down along party lines. This is about patients and their doctors and getting access to the care that you deserve.
Okay, so now, but they also decided something else, my understanding is, and that was about, there's another question that we put before the voters, and that is about the legalization of recreational marijuana for adults. So I have a couple of questions about that. What's the polling on that? What does legalization mean? Who's going to get to sell it? And if they're going to raise revenue from this legalization of pot, where is that money going? Because it'll get, again, I mean, I look at all these bills as being kind of an octopus, and they have different arms. One is the legalization arm. Who gets to sell it arm? Where does the money from the revenue go? All those things become an enhancer or a detractor to what voters are going to be asked to do in November. So can you, you know, spend a little bit of time talking about pot, and then I want to then sort of put the two of them together because they're in some ways synergistic.
So my understanding from public polling that I have seen is that the recreational marijuana amendment is also polling in the mid to high 60s among Floridians right now. You know, that comes on the heel of Floridians just a few years ago legalizing medical marijuana by over 60% into our Florida Constitution. The way the amendment is written, my understanding is that it would integrate under the vertical integration system that we have now. So a lot of those medical marijuana providers would be the same people providing that recreational marijuana here in the state. Where that revenue is going to go, I believe, is still up for debate. That'll be something that we'll have to figure out in the implementation process. But I know the Florida Policy Institute, who does a lot of good work on this, thinks that this could generate over $400 million in additional revenue every single year for the state. In a place where we have serious deficiencies in how we are funding public health, as you mentioned, as how we are funding public education, that is money that could really do a lot of good for the people of Florida. And I think also this is a criminal justice issue. There are a lot of people in this state who are caught up with low-level marijuana offenses, who have that put on their record, who then do not have the opportunities in life that they should have. And so for a lot of people here in the state of Florida, this is a big, big deal, because it's going to allow us to move forward with a position that's popular among people here in the state of Florida, will generate revenue for really programs.
Oh, I know, I know.
And will also help a lot of people avoid getting caught up in criminal justice issues.
Okay, so being the old politician that I am, I describe myself as a politician in recovery. I am looking at this through these political lens. And through my political lens, I have a couple things I want to ask you. And that is that we saw when they passed, for example, allowing ex-felons to be able to sort of exercise the vote, when they raised the minimum wage in Florida, they then moved it up to that 60%. 60% threshold, thinking it would never pass. But guess what? Both of them passed with over 60%. But what happened, though, for example, with ex-felons being able to be restored with the ability to vote, was you saw that they put all these impediments in. So even though the voters overwhelmingly expressed their wish, the legislature, which is a MAGA conservative reactionary legislature run by Ron DeSantis, they basically dragged their knuckles or made it very difficult to impossible to actually follow through with what the voters wanted. So as we approach these referenda that are going to be put before voters, it seems to me that one of the most important questions asked of members who are running for the state Senate and for the state House, what will you do to ensure that it is implemented? Because not only do I think that Republicans have no capacity to embrace these referenda, I think they have no capacity into believing that the will and the wishes of the voters are going to be recognized. And I mean, I think it's in a lot of ways, we need to connect the dots between Republicans and Democrats, because Republicans, even when the people pass it, don't want to embrace it. And the Democrats, not only are they running on this issue, but they will guarantee that your will be respected. It seems to me this could change the course of Floridian politics, not just for Joe Biden, but what happens in the MAGA legislature that you currently have that's been rubber stamping Ron DeSantis.
I think these amendments are both, and especially the abortion amendment, are very, very clear in how they should be implemented and how they should be applied to people here in the state of Florida. The legislature obviously will have some role in the implementation of this, but people should know that when they make their voices heard at the polls this fall, they are voting to restore freedoms that have been taken away from them, and that they are making loud and clear that they believe should be respected by this legislature. When folks vote on abortion, when they vote on recreational marijuana, when they vote up and down the ballot this fall, the number one issue that's going to be animating people here in Florida is protecting freedoms. And that all goes back to a lot of the other issues that you talked about too, that have been played into this. There's affordability issues here in the state of Florida. There are issues with our public education system. People deserve the freedom to be healthy, prosperous, and safe. And when they go to the polls this fall, I believe that they will be making that decision, and they will be making their voices heard loud and clear to the people who will be making laws for us over the next 2 years after that.
So I want to read a headline back to you. It's disheartening. Thousands of Florida kids are losing Medicaid coverage on Easter Sunday. I mean, you can't make this up. And once again, everyone, it's the children. It's the children. So explain to me how these Christians that, you know, basically run on their form of Christian nationalism and their evangelicalism, and Ron DeSantis wraps himself up in his Catholicism and his love of Jesus and his belief in, you know, whatever the Bible says, which apparently they never read. Explain to me what happened here and why were these kids thrown off? How long ago was this implemented? And then finally they pulled the trigger. And I want to know, why would anybody want to do this? What's the upside?
Well, one of the other big issues that we have here in the state of Florida, and I believe I talked about this a few weeks ago, we are one of 10 states that still has not expanded access to Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. But during the pandemic, President Joe Biden and Congress enacted a lot of laws that expanded your ability to get care. In Florida, that meant that hundreds of thousands, actually, I believe more than a million children, were able to get access to Medicaid services that they had never had in the past. Now, since they've started this unwinding of these pandemic era programs, many states have worked to ensure that people get continuous care, especially children, that they don't drop off, that they don't lose access to services. Florida's taken the opposite approach. We have now kicked almost 600,000 children off of their Medicaid during this unwinding process that started more than a year and a half ago. I believe that average wait times for people trying to call our Department of Children and Family Services to figure out what's going on has been over an hour. Folks who speak Spanish as their first language are having an incredibly hard time getting through to anyone to talk about any of these issues. The legislature, of course, did not allocate any more money to deal with this, to open new call centers, to put more people onto the case. So what we've seen is that children and people in the state of Florida, working folks who fall into that Medicaid donut hole right now, that can't get care, that are getting access to care in other states, are falling off, and we are losing them during this readjustment period. It's awful. You know, I've seen numerous stories now. There was a great story in the Tampa Bay area, a great story in terms of how it was reported, but not what was going on, of a child with autism who, for the first time ever, had gotten access to the type of care that he needed, was nonverbal, that was kicked off on April 1st from his care. And his family is still fighting to make sure that he gets the services that he needs. It's so important, again, and it goes back to what we were talking about. People need to come out and vote and make sure that people know that taking away freedoms like this, freedom to the health care that you and your family needs, freedom from to have the financial security to know that you can provide that care to yourself and your family. These are top of mind issues for every single Floridian and what they're going to be voting on when they head to the polls in November.
And I'm going to connect the dots to what the Supreme Court did vis-a-vis abortion, where now you're going to get in 30 days the 6-week abortion ban. And I'm going to connect it to the fact that voters want to have a choice on their ballot in November of 2024. And that is that as horrific as it is, but when you see someone having something and then losing something, their anger and their passion changes. So for the 600,000 parents whose kids have been removed from Medicaid, they better understand why they need to vote. For the people that need to access an abortion, want that choice, know about what it means for their families, for their children, for their whatever it means, you have this right, and they are now taking it away from you. And therefore, when you have something and you lose it, understand that policy matters. Understand that elections matter. Understand that your choices matter. Your choices. So I'm hoping that the 600,000 children and their parents, that they have a sphere of influence and they connect the dots to what they need to do in November of 2024. I hope the women and the families and the healthcare professionals who realize how their ability to basically take care of women, to take care of women has been compromised. You have this and you are losing it because of what? Because of Ron DeSantis and the Republicans in the legislature. Well, you know what? You have a way of expressing your concern, one, with a referendum vote, but two, guess what? You got to connect it to people. Because in the end, it is the people that stripped you of these things. Those people need to be removed. Oh my God, Andrews, I'm like out of my mind.
And Arnie, if I could interject, I think that one thing that we know more than anything else here is that Floridians value their freedom from government interference. And what they heard from our governor and from their state legislators for the last couple of years is how they were protecting their freedoms, all the things they were doing to protect their freedoms. Well, those laws that were passed in 2021 and 2022 and 2023, they're starting to be implemented. And people here in
Right.
Florida are starting to see that their freedoms were not protected. In fact, their freedoms were under attack every single day. The freedom to learn, the freedom for their children to get books in school, the freedom for their children to have the resources they need to succeed in school, the freedom from government interference in private healthcare decisions that should be between a patient and their doctor were taken away. The freedom of LGBTQ people in our state to exist and to live their lives every single day without the fear that the government was going to be cracking down on them. These are the freedoms that have been under attack here in the state of Florida. And I think when people go to the polls this November, now that they've seen what these policies mean in their everyday lives, you're
Exactly.
going to see a real roar from the people of Florida.
And I'm going to put an exclamation point on that. Why, Andrews? Because I'm looking at an NBC News piece. Here we go. Here's the headline, everyone. They came for Florida's sun and sand. They got soaring costs and a culture war. Florida has seen a population boom in recent years, but many longtime residents and recent transplants say rising costs and divisive politics have them fleeing the Sunshine State. And I'm going to add to that story because the NAACP has recommended to all black athletes, don't even consider Florida as a place where you want to play basketball, football, swimming, soccer. Avoid it. Don't go there. Don't apply there. Look at another state. And as I pointed out the other day on my Facebook page, if it isn't a good place for black athletes, who the hell should be going there anyway? It shouldn't just be a black athlete that should feel frightened about why this is not a safe place. It should be everyone with a pulse. So as much as I know you love your state, it's not about your loving it. It's about changing the leadership of your state.
Absolutely. Florida, to me, is still, with all of the things that we have here, probably the best place in America to raise a family with the right leadership. One of the big things that we've seen over the last 5+ years now under Governor DeSantis is that politics has been injected into every single part of your lives here, and people are tired of it. Folks want to be able to go to a restaurant, to go to their PTA meeting, to talk to fellow parents and fellow citizens without having to worry about politics being injected into every single aspect of their lives. And the biggest issue with that is those politics aren't actually even making their lives any better. As that article you mentioned states, Floridian people who have moved here over the last couple of years because of that rhetoric that's come from the governor and from those in state leadership, what rhetoric does not point out is that Florida is one of the most expensive places in the country to live. We have five out of the top 10 most overpriced housing markets in the country. The price of property insurance in the state of Florida has risen more than 100% over the last 4 years. It is more than four times the national average here in the state of Florida. And it's the hidden costs. While Florida may not have a state income tax, we have some of the highest sales taxes here in the country. Because a lot of the things that are that would normally be funded that way are funded through local services that have to be picked up by local governments, who also, by the way, are being hit for unfunded mandates from our state government. And while we pride ourselves on not having a state income tax, and we never will here because it's in our Florida Constitution that we won't, there are a lot of hidden taxes and a lot of hidden fees that come with living in the state of Florida that they don't tell you about when they are preaching about the freedom that so exists here in the state of Florida, except for the freedom to pay your bills and to be able to plan for the future and save for retirement that most Floridians cannot enjoy in one of the lowest wage states in the country.
So, Anders, you mentioned that politics is being injected into every aspect of people's lives, and they're beginning to see it because the bills that were passed in 2021 and 2022 and 2023 are now being implemented, and the consequences of those bills is now being felt. Okay? That's the good news. But I want to say something. I'm not sure it's just politics that is being injected into every aspect of their lives. It is their definition of morality. You see, now we have to remember that they're playing the evangelical Christian card, that they are now not just calling it politics, but they're pulling their politics through the lens of their definition of their version of Christianity. Not Christianity that Jesus would recognize, nothing that you really read about in the Bible. But because of that, it is even more toxic because they are now not just playing the political card, they're playing their moral card. And the most important thing is, it's their morality. It has no respect for you. It has no respect for your faith. It has no respect for your life. It has no respect for your circumstances, as we were talking about when it comes to women's health. They want to walk in your shoes. They want to dictate to your doctor. They want to dictate to your husband. They want to dictate to your body. And I think that we can't not forget that it's this morality piece that in some ways makes it even more noxious, because they've now blended it with their politics, and therefore they have this almost this arrogance that is frightening, and at the same time, it is so undermining of the respect that you should be given and of the future you should have.
I think Floridians from Pensacola to the Keys work hard and they respect their neighbors, they respect their communities, they respect who we are as people here in the state of Florida. They deserve the freedom to be healthy, prosperous, and safe. They deserve lower costs, higher wages, and an affordable future for all of us. They deserve to know that when they work hard, they will have enough money to keep a roof over their family's heads, to plan and save for retirement, and to ensure that their family can live out the version of the American dream that they think they deserve. That's what we're fighting for here in the state of Florida. I think it's what every Floridian actually wants at the end of the day. They don't want politics injected and a part of every single decision that is made in every single part of their lives. They simply want a state government that looks out for them and that works for them, not the corporate elite, not the major corporations that fund campaigns or fund political ambitions. Floridians deserve to have representation that puts their needs first. And I believe that this fall, when they go to the ballot box, they're going to make that choice known.
Interestingly enough, when Ron DeSantis was running for president and everyone thought that he might be the one to actually dismantle the Trump campaign, he used Florida as his political petri dish. And what he did was he thought he could go more extreme than even Donald Trump, although we don't even know what Donald Trump believes. So I'm not sure how you can go more extreme than him since it changes by the hour. But I want Florida to understand you are the experiment. You were his experiment. Well, his experiment running for president, it blew up. It failed. His experiment in Florida is harming every aspect of your life. He was a bad leader to possibly run for president. He's probably a bad governor, But worse than being a bad governor, it's the policies that he's basically sort of thrusting on you and what it means for you. And you have a lot on your plate in 2024. It's not just about Biden. It's about your future. Anyway, Anders Croy, thank you so much for doing this. You were the right person at the right time. Anders is the communications director for Florida Watch and DeSantis Watch and Accountability Project. Again, we will be talking, I'm sure, every couple of weeks. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Arnie.
You're welcome. This, everyone, is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality. For so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war. Where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Tuesday morning. We've actually hung out with John Austin before. He directs the Michigan Economic Center and is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He wrote a piece at Time.com, and it was entitled, Why the U.S. Economy is Surging as China Stumbles. And I think it's really important, John, that we have a sort of a clearer image of what exactly is the strength and the weaknesses of the Chinese economy, what it is that we should embrace and what it is that we should potentially fear. You talk about something that I think is really important, and I want people to understand that in a lot of ways, there was a subtext to your article that it wasn't just about talking about the Chinese economy, but it was about talking about something called ally shoring. A-L-L-Y, shoring. And I want you to eventually back into that because I think that's your sort of your prescription for how we need to address the situation that we're now seeing in China. So let me welcome you back to the program. Thank you so much for doing this, John.
Great to join you again.
So let's talk a little bit about, as you begin, every so often a grand thesis captures the world's imagination. Began an article in the New Yorker in 2008. The latest is that America's time of global dominance is finished and the new powers such as China, India, and Russia are poised to take over. So now let's fast forward to 2024. So let's talk about what we saw in 2008, which to some extent may have been somewhat accurate, but like everything else, things change, leadership changes, demographics change, and What you anticipate may not be able to be as resilient as you thought back in 2008. So explain to us what you are now seeing in China from an economic perspective, because Xi is in control. He's probably going to be permanently in control because that's what he wants, but he isn't necessarily the best person when it comes to playing out a vital economic structure for China. And that's maybe in part because he wants to solidify all control in him, which doesn't always work well when it comes to economics.
Yeah, and I even want to take us back to 1987. I was a young man working for the governor of Massachusetts in our Massachusetts Office of International Trade. And we had a sister state relationship with Guangzhou province, which was the first test province in China that Deng Xiaoping, in his sort of genius, allowed to kind of open up and trade and do business openly with the West. And we had a delegation from China. It was classic of the time. It had a Communist Party minder keeping track of everybody so no one ran off. They couldn't afford to stay at a hotel downtown because they had no hard currency. So they were way out in Framingham at a motel. And they didn't speak English, and they sold textiles and pottery and things like that at this international trade expo. Fast forward to 5 or 10 years ago, I'm amazed because we have Chinese business people trotting the globe. No one's worried about them running away. If anything, they're doing deals. They're doing business. They're cutting deals on how to produce things in China or develop new technologies or do research with our universities. And it was really Deng Xiaoping 50 years ago who said, let's open up basically to and participate in this market-driven, open, free trade, capitalist environment of the world. And that's what they did. And it unleashed millions, literally, of very entrepreneurial, creative people to do business and make a living and apply their creative talents to the world. And it worked. And China grew and in all sorts of industries, but first as the kind of the manufacturing center for the world. But also, they actually showed that they, different from Japan and Germany, who've had their moments of robust economic success. Remember, we were worried about Japan Inc. eating our economic lunch
exactly,
in the 80s.
Exactly.
The Chinese were even on their way to being the innovators, creating new high-tech products. Look at Huawei and look at even TikTok, which those other competitors could never find a way to do, to be kind of the innovative, cutting-edge, tech-driven leaders. But what happened starting 5 or 10 years ago with Xi, he basically, in my view, began to kind of throttle the golden goose that lays the golden egg, which is
exactly
this freebooting, open, creative, participate, do business in the world with who you want, how you want, by turning it into a politically directed, state-controlled, politicizing decisions. You can't do business here unless you conform to our expectations that you won't talk about Uyghurs or anything else. His own entrepreneurs are now fleeing the country. They're tired and they don't want to be part of a state mind control surveillance regime that doesn't let them do what they want in the world. And so you're seeing the signs of it. China's economy, as we wrote, is tanking. They won't even report accurate statistics anymore because consumers, people there who are so optimistic, this great middle class and young people, so we're going to enjoy, a higher standard of living. Now they don't think they have a future. There's no jobs. They've basically, after years of benefiting by applying their creative genius and their entrepreneurial energy in the world economy, are now choking it back by inevitable. In my view, you can't have a state directed. This is how you must behave. This is how you must think. Economy that it doesn't work in the long run. Look at the former Soviet Union. Ultimately, people want something different. They don't want that. And so you see, and also then when it became clear that China COVID really opened my eyes and all our eyes, hey, they've actually worked hard to subsidize key sectors so that they can have dependency on them in PPV, for example. We realized that right away, are now critical minerals that we need in our smartphones and our semiconductors. And they want to use those dependencies for political and economic coercion. Don't ask the right questions. Don't question our our political decisions or our civil rights abuses, or will not do business with you with these things you need. And they're holding that over the heads of lots of countries around the world that they've invested in through Belt and Road, which actually gives them lots of money, builds lots of debt, allows them to put pocket, you know, dollars in the pockets of autocrats around the world who become their friends. And that's the model of development that China wants to replace with our kind of open, free trade, transparent rules, non-corrupting development regime that we've, you know, we've helped make the norm, and China has benefited by participating.
So I'm thinking about what you were describing. So I rent to law students from my house, and I'm three blocks away from UNH Law School, which also has a master's program, the Franklin Pierce College of like Intellectual Property. Okay, it's a 1-year master's course. About 5 or 6 years ago, I would say the number of Chinese students that applied to live at my house was, I had to say no to them. There were so many. And what was it? Intellectual property. Think about it. Just what you're describing. These entrepreneurs, what were they doing? Being creative, thinking outside the box, doing all the stuff. In the last 2 or 3 years, of course, the pandemic helped. You know, no problem there. But the number of Chinese students has declined significantly. And that is a bad omen for the kind of economics that you're describing. There's no question about it. And I go back to the fact that my daughter's husband is from Shanghai, and the fear of being able to find work is now something that is part of his everyday experience. The other thing is that we talk about the demographic bomb that's about to happen, that's already happened. And that is that not only do they have an incredibly aging population, but they have this younger population that doesn't want to get married, that doesn't want to have children. So even though they used to have the one child policy, then they changed it to the two child policy, then they changed it to the three child policy, they could probably pay people to have babies and they won't have them. But part of the problem is, John, and this is absolutely true, I've told this story a million times. So my daughter starts dating this guy in Shanghai. And finally, she says to him, do you want to like ask me out? And they've been like sort of hanging out together for almost a year, okay? And he said, I think I do. And Melissa goes, okay. And then he says, but there's something you need to know, Melissa. And Melissa says, okay, and what's that? And this guy's like in his late 20s, early 30s. He goes, I'm still a virgin. And Melissa goes, okay, well, here's the deal, I'm not. So, but what that tells you is there aren't enough women. There aren't enough women. So you have all these men who have no one that they can date. You have a problem with the demographics. You have the problem with the babies. You have the problem with Xi trying to control everything. You have what happened during the pandemic where they sealed people off and actually taped their doors shut. And it was the government that sent them food. And you look at all these things, and these are just a prescription, not for success, but what is so predictably failure. And I am just trying to figure out, how is Xi going to hold control over this when you saw the rise of the largest middle class in the world in China, and now all that is being dismantled? And my question is, how do you keep people stable in that kind of a situation?
Well, and that's the point, is you can't forever. And I think right. what's really changed is sort of the intent behind their policies. You know, we had for years, I certainly welcomed these delegations of Chinese academics coming to, I'm based at University of Michigan. They were coming to our great universities to learn, and also to learn how do these institutions work, because we want to replicate them, because we know they're important as engines of, you know, new discovery and research and talent building. And we thought, this is great. You know, it's great. The Chinese are getting engaged in the world. They're going to build their own people's skills, abilities, talents, creativity. And we saw the fruits of that. But now they're coming in recent years to with intent such as, oh, think tanks, you work for Brookings, a delegation that wanted to interview me and did about how, basically how do think tanks work so that they could figure out how to manipulate and seed and support their own think tanks in America that would infect our public dialogue with what Chinese, you know, Communist Party wanted to say. You probably saw the stories up in Canada where they backed Chinese diaspora residents to get elected to parliament so that they can influence Canada's policy vis-a-vis China. So it's not as critical and confrontational. And that's the kind of thing I was staying in hotels in Europe, and I was wondering why there's a Motel One's chain in Brussels, Berlin. Why is CNN and MSNBC on the cable here disabled? I mean, it just doesn't work. But there's four stations of basically Chinese propaganda, of wonderful China this, China that. And then I looked, the owner is a German businessman who's the front for some Chinese investor interests and political interests. So they're doing these things, which are about kind of, upsetting and destabilizing opinion in our country, but also about having us affirm and work together with other allies to be strong vis-a-vis, we want to keep a rules-based, open, freedom-affirming international set of politics, norms, economy. And that's not what China wants. It's not what Russia wants.
So in your piece in Time, you write that, so this is an opportunity to seize the moment. But of course, you point out that Joe Biden is somewhat distracted, of course. I mean, how could he not be distracted? Donald Trump distracts the world, let alone Joe Biden. It's about 2024. And we know that the future of democracy is on the line. You know, we're all learning about Project 2025, and we're all horrified by it because they're telling us what they're going to do. They're to every detail, they're telling us what they're going to do. So you can't say you don't know. Now the question is, do you want to elect it? Is really what the question becomes. But you write that, the U.S. is not seizing the moment. And my question is, at this point in time, I'm not sure how he could, and maybe you can tell me how he could, given what's on his plate right now. But what does seizing the moment mean? What is it? What is your prescription for the U.S. Economy, for the Biden administration? How is it that we should approach China? I don't want to create an enemy. I want to create a situation of respect. Everything doesn't have to be my way or the highway. But at the same time, what is it that we need to build for both our own resiliency? I mean, we're beginning to see that with remanufacturing going on, changing the supply chains, beginning to understand, what happened during the pandemic. Nobody had a mask. Why? Because all the masks were made in China. All of a sudden we need to understand, we need to diversify our portfolio, as they say. So what is it that you're recommending that the U.S. should do in order to seize the moment, not to make China an enemy, but to use this as an opportunity for stability and growth?
And that's really my motivation for writing this article is, if we're all Republicans and Democrats, even Republicans in Congress, and even Donald Trump say they're concerned about kind of China's manipulating and trying to knock down the rules-based international order, you don't do that by walking away from leadership of the international coalition of largely democratic countries that need to hang together and work together and even strengthen our own collective economies, which is the true source of political influence. And so seizing the moment means, China and Russia are different. They both would rather have authoritarian states and friendly other authoritarians sort of rule the world. Russia's economy is a Potemkin village. If they didn't have nuclear weapons, we really wouldn't need to worry about Russia because they can't hold the rest of us hostage with dependencies on their critical minerals and the economy once we get past, the reliance on oil and gas. China's a different story. It succeeded and grew, and it's now a global player. Our businesses still want their big market. They want to play in the world and have lots of, they control 90% of critical minerals, that cobalt and things that we need in all our high tech products. So they're a different animal. So what we need to do, and what Biden was doing during his 3 or 4 years, was, let's rope together the family of nations. Let's not try to go it alone and retreat from the world. Let's support the collective work together. Let's source and rewire supply chains. And that's Alex Horn, with friends and countries who share our values, that want to strengthen, not weaken, an open free trade economic order that will strengthen our collective economies. And that will give us a united front vis-a-vis the China and the Russia, where we do need to counter their bad behavior and malevolence in the world.
So I'm going back to an article that I read in the Washington Monthly in 2020. God, you can tell I've been doing this job for way too long, John. And the title was, Washington and Brussels Need a New Special Relationship. Coordinating reforms helped save the global economy after the 2008 crash. It can save us again. And I'm thinking about, in a lot of ways, that reordering of our relationships, of our supply chains, of what we're encouraging. And that rather than being horrified by what we see in China, just say, okay, you do your thing. We're going to figure out another way to sort of reinforce what it is that we need to do economically, that we need to sort of create these relationships where we can sort of help each other. And as one of the things that the Chinese really began to understand was that how come all this creativity and ingenuity was happening in the United States and not happening in China? What was this problem with our control over everything that it turned out that we controlled this entrepreneurism and this creativity, which in the end is the economic juggernaut? It's just so interesting to me that they were jealous of what we did. But what they didn't realize was keeping things open and free and flexible is probably the key to making those things possible.
Yeah, and they were beginning to be more successful than other nations ever had been at supporting people to be creative, innovative, create new high-tech empires, like which always come from our country because we have the most dynamic, innovative, creative family of sort of market-driven business people on the planet, a lot of them immigrants. But so it's tragic that China, and tragic for them, the Chinese people, as we're seeing, that they... in their mania to have state direction, state control, mind control, not allow differing points of view to be heard, they're throttling the entrepreneurial creative genius of their own people, and that's taking down China's economic strength. So at this moment in time, I mean, and again, it goes back to intent. We need to work together with countries that want to support growth and freedom of expression and freedom to do business and engage with people who you want to, whoever they are, wherever they are. And, you know, I always say it's really only Donald Trump and the prospect of his reelection where he just says, okay, we're going to abandon Ukraine. We're going to walk away from leadership of this alliance of freedom supporting democratic nations. That gives China and Russia exactly what they want, which is because China particularly is very influential, economically entangled in the world. It leaves Europe and Asian allies on their own. Together, we can negotiate much more strongly. And I use this example. It's not a problem for us to get almost all of our semiconductor manufacturing done in Taiwan. Except that China could swallow Taiwan tomorrow. It's actually a great thing because we could count on Taiwan. They're going to be part of our open, free business trade system. The only reason we're now needing to get into the semiconductor manufacturing business, yes, it's good to create some jobs, but is because China might swallow Taiwan. The reason why we're having a debate about the future of TikTok is because, yes, China has likely already used that business, which is incredibly creative and a real marvel of innovation that China uniquely, you know, did to both harvest information, surveil on our own citizens, and potentially spread misinformation during our election year to screw up our public debate. And both of those things, they have shown a great interest and they have a track record of doing both of those things.
So again, so my daughter lived in China. I think she moved there about 10 years ago. So a little bit at the very beginning of the transition from what we are now seeing with Xi, and Xi has now just really completely, you know, instituted his control. But one of the things that she was hired to do is she was a theater major at the University of Iowa. And one of the things that the schools were realizing is maybe what they needed to do is to bring into Chinese schools music and theater and creative writing. that maybe they needed to be a little more creative and flexible and mm-hmm. different and quirky, and that maybe one of the reasons why they were able in the United States to be able to sort of create these amazing inventions was that they weren't so rigid in what they did, but they also saw the advantage that, you know, look at music support of math. Look at what theater is able to, I mean, again, it was just, and but that's why they hired her. Because they were trying to figure out, what are they doing in the United States that we're not doing? Oh, wow, we know they're doing a little bit of theater and music. We need to do that too. And that's one of the things they brought her in for. And I'm just smiling as I hear what you're saying, because in a lot of ways, my fear is we're becoming China, that we're taking away the theater and the music, that Donald Trump really is an admirer of Xi, you know, and an admirer of the dictator of North Korea. He wants to do command and control. He wants to drain the vitality out. And so what you're seeing in China, which is, look what this is doing to their economy, this kind of leadership, imagine what it will do in the United States.
Exactly. And there was a China hand, Ken Dawaskin, China expert, University of Michigan. His wife taught high school, and my kids had her. Their daughter is like your daughter?
Yeah,
she went to China. She spent years, and she became like a soap opera celebrity in Chinese television. She was, you know, the evil, you know, conniving American. But they were encouraging this kind of, you know,
yes,
back and forth and creative thing. And that's all to the good for China, good for us. And now they're not. Now that you can't, they're trying to control what people think. Punish them if they associate with the wrong people. But several years ago, I've gotten a lot of calls from reporters over the years on how, you know, what's going on in the economy of Michigan and the Midwest with Trump elected. One was from the Ming Pao Daily, Taiwan, in Hong Kong. And they said, we're okay. Hong Kong's leading independent newspaper, and we'd like to talk to you. And I said, okay. Then I asked my China friend in Dawaskin at the University of Michigan, goes, yeah, they used to be until the Communist Party muscled in and the newspapers in Hong Kong and others, they chopped up the former editor with machetes and got that news outlet in line. And that's the kind of thing, unfortunately, that they're doing, which is the opposite of nurturing an open, free, creative, happy family of effort. Because, you know, Chinese are amazing people. They've shown that they can do things that some of our alleged, you know, people who are going to eat our economic lunch could never do. The Germans and Japanese never figured out how to drive new, innovative, high-tech inventions that change the game.
Well, and let me just end this way. So one of the big questions I have, and I want you to think about this, John Austin. John Austin directs the Michigan Economic Center and is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. We've been talking about China's stumble from his article at Time Magazine. And that is that the Chinese have also figured out a way to make a very cheap electric vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Very cheap electric vehicle.
Well, they're now, subsidizing it.
I understand. But at the same time, we want to move towards EVs. And when you're looking at the cost of an EV being $45,000, I don't know about you, but most of my friends are just barely making $45,000. And then you look at what these EVs cost, like $10,000 or $12,000. And yes, they're being subsidized. One, it sort of, it creates an interesting tension as to what it is we need to do. Do we need to move to EVs? Do we need to deal with the problem of the climate crisis? How quickly can we move? Is this a threat or is this an opportunity? And I'm just going to end this way. Many, many years ago, when I was going off to Minneapolis, Minnesota, I bought a Honda. And you know what the bumper sticker said on my Honda? My bumper sticker said, I would have rather bought American. All right, just to let you know, that was 1976. And on that note, Mr. Austin, thank you so much for doing this. I'm sure we'll call you again.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producer Steve Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You bet.